This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Artist Monet Noel Marshall had a burning question. Can we put a price on our bodies and our souls? For Monet, it's a question that closely is linked to race and capitalism. She's also created a body of work to answer that question and to help others determine their own worth. The Buy It, Call It Trilogy is a series of experiential performance pieces at locations throughout the Triangle. Her second piece in the series premieres next week, and Monet is back on our program. Welcome back. Good to have you here.
Thank you so much.
Tell us about this the concept behind Buy It, Call It. What's the trilogy about?
Absolutely. So the trilogy for me is about levels. It's like an unveiling, a taking off. So the first piece was very much about what's on the outer layer for me as a Black artist and my relationship to systems and institutions and a lot of them that are predominantly white and exist in capitalism and the ways that that can feel really harmful. So then once I was able to take that off, then the next layer is me. Like it's me grappling and dealing with my own body and my own identity and the ways that that is perceived and treated in the world and by myself and the stories that I carry. And then the third piece is about soul. It's about like sacredness and holiness and grace and what's underneath all of it.
Well, let's take them one at a time and go back. We've talked a little bit about it, but let's go back to that first layer and tell us how you reflected that artistically.
Yeah. So the piece was a moving, interactive, experiential experience. Mm-hmm. And so folks moved from scene to scene. And it's like the very first thing they came to was a Black man dancing in this box. And you put money in, you come around the other side, and it's folks who are representing like nonprofit structures, like, oh, pulling the money out of the air. But like, we don't have enough money. I wish they funded the arts more, all of that. So all the scenes really play with who is creating and who's actually receiving funding or who's receiving capital or who is capitalizing off of creation. And at the very end, folks meet me at the very end of the show and sit across from a table, and I asked them, so how much will you pay me for my work? And they got to decide how much they wanted to pay for their experience that evening.
Well, tell us about what you experienced in that.
Well, the very first time I did it for real in the show, I realized that it had nothing to do with me, that this is actually giving other people practice for us to put a face on the ways that we exchange money. Because we're so used to it being so separate from people. And what does it mean to have to sit across from someone and say, I'm going to pay you $10 for your work or $0 for your work or $100 for your work. And the number doesn't matter. It's actually about what happens between us in that relationship.
Well, and that's where, I mean, you talk about capitalism. That's what mm-hmm. capitalism did in primarily was to destroy those social relations and replace them with these commodified alien relations. Mm-hmm. So one of the first, and you said something interesting. You said, how much would I pay for my work? Mm-hmm. Another trick of capitalism. We don't pay you for your work, right? We pay you for your time, and then we capitalize on the product.
Right.
So the owner capitalizes on the product, and some part of the work gets lost in there and goes back to the owner, even though somebody paid a full price for the product. The worker gets only part of the price. That's one of the great tricks.
Yeah.
That's one of the in the shell game. And you put your finger on that with by asking, what would you pay for my work? Not the piece, mm-hmm. but the work.
My work. And I didn't say for my art, because I think there's also right. a subconscious message around what art is worth and art not being work.
So what happens to people when they're suddenly confronted with this? It's like, oh my goodness, there've been all these shells and this shell game and these mirrors and screens between me and the individual and the work. What happens to them? What are they telling you?
The thing I heard the most is, I'm sorry. I got a lot of apologies. I'm sorry I couldn't pay you more. I wish I could give you more money, all of that. And it just really made me, like, I didn't put any judgment on no matter what amount people said.
Right.
So it really was personal about their relationship and what they thought their worth was in that moment because of what they could give.
Yeah.
And I just found that really interesting.
And the other, that great exchange medium, too, mm-hmm. is like money. Well, now money's got this kind of value because it buys that much, you know, stuff on Amazon.
Right.
But how do I do it here? So let's talk about how you get interested in all of this in the first place. I know that you worked at the North Carolina Symphony for a while, and you were paying close attention to who was making the art and who was getting the money and all that. Tell us
yeah.
about that.
Yeah. So I've had the opportunity to work at a lot of arts nonprofits in the Triangle, but particularly with the symphony, I worked in the box office. So I had the privilege to sit and watch all the people come by and purchase their tickets and walk into the theater. And I noticed that our arts organizations, our audience, and the people making work were predominantly white. At the time that I worked there, there was one black man in the actual symphony. He was a percussionist out of their very large, like, orchestra. And, like, so it just really dawned on me. But then, like, the only time it had a large mass of particularly black folks is when they would do their mix with Boys to Men. It'd be Boys to Men and the symphony, and then the demographics would be so different for that one evening. And it wasn't about their relationship with the symphony. It was like, oh, I'm coming to see this one artist, and then I might see you next year or whenever this happens again. And it just really made me question, who are we making art for?
Well, let's talk about this, the art market, right? Because it is now a market. It's something that's growing. I mean, just this month, P. Diddy was revealed as the secret buyer, $21 million paid for by a painting by African-American artist Kerry James Marshall. Any relation?
No, I wish. Relation.
but the work depicts black figures. So that's, we think, is the most ever paid for a work by a living artist. Mm-hmm. A lot of money from a black entertainer.
A living black artist.
A black artist paying a black artist. That sounds like what you're looking for.
It
you
sounds have some like it. But, you know, when we dig a little bit deeper, I think it still shows the ways that the arts market doesn't actually serve artists all the time. Because Kerry James Marshall sold this piece in 96 for $25,000. So somewhere between the $25,000 and $21 million, he actually doesn't have access to the different times that it may have crossed hands. Whereas in Europe, they have a law where when it's sold, the artist gets 5% of the profit. So anytime it's sold, then they get 5% of that. So they still have right to the thing that they created with their bodies and their minds. But we don't have that here, so he doesn't see that.
Right. And that's just a feature of American law, and it would apply to black and white artists equally. But you're saying this is kind of some of the problem. Talk about this next. So the first layer, as you say, was kind of the outer layer, the coat. And now this next piece that opens next week. Tell us more about that.
This layer is the skin. When I was working on this piece, I really thought it was going to be more about some of the ways that other people have enacted things on my body or like other stories. But as I did more work, I was like, oh, Monet, this is about you. This is about the stories that you are carrying inside. This is about the things that you need to heal. And I think that there is something that can be very universal when we do work in specificity. And the specificity of this piece is me. It's like my stuff and airing it out as folks say, you know, you can't heal what you don't reveal, right? And I'm an artist, so I reveal things in really public ways.
Did that become a research project for you, or were these things you were already telling yourself, or did you have to kind of dig deep and say, what's down there?
I've had to dig deep. I'm still in rehearsal digging deep right now. my cast will ask me really hard questions like, Monet, do you think you're strong? Like, for their character research, I'm like, oh, God, now we're in therapy.
You started it.
I did start it. I did. But I do feel really grateful for the work. And it's been really difficult to, like, get past the performative nature of identity and what I present every day and get down to some stuff that I don't show folks.
Well, tell us more about it, about the performance. I mean, what are we going
to
see?
Yeah, so this piece is similar to the first piece, but different. So there's going to be some installations that folks get to move through, kind of like Carnival Midway, but with my own kind of sardonic spin on some of the things. And then the second half of the piece is like a circus performance. So I get to play a ringmaster and do all of that. But then even in there, there's some surprises. So do you want to talk about some of the pieces?
Well, yeah.
Awesome. So in the installation side, there's one piece called Mirrors, Windows, Questions, and Prompts. So playing on the idea of a carnival funhouse mirror, but so it'll be a maze, but you'll get the mirrors. You'll also see windows, so you'll see other folks moving past. And then you'll have prompts like take a deep breath or questions like what wars are you committing against your body, right? So, and for me, it's really about all that's about perspective. Funhouse mirrors about perspective and shifting perspective. So how do we do that in questions and prompts and all these other things? So that's one example. Do you want to know?
Keep going. I've got some questions for you. But let's stop right there because this whole, you know, we had Yaba Blay on the show last week and we were talking about some of this because, you know, she's got her project now that talks about performance, but also about appearance and about what it means to perform as a black girl, right?
Yes.
And I said, ask her some question about, well, isn't all sort of a persona a kind of a performance? Isn't fashion about performance? And she said, yeah, well, yes and no. I mean, but to some extent, it reflects kind of who we really are. So when we put on, right, when we make ourselves up, To some extent, we're performing for other people and to their expectations, but it also says something about ourselves. Is that something you wrestle with or think about in terms of this? Because we do perform every day. There's no who I am.
Right.
There's who I am on the radio. There's who I am with my grandchildren, right?
Right. And we do. I think Yaba Blay and the work that she's doing with Professional Black Girl is exactly a great example for that piece, because there's one character, like, thinking about clowning, but clowning as in, like, through black girlhood. Because I think there's something that is Afrofuturistic about black girlhood, in that we are told, like, to be a child, but also I'm going to treat you a little bit older because the world is going to see you as older, and maybe your body developed in a way that the world treats you like that. So I'm going to also make you be older so that you can protect yourself. But then also you might be raised in a multi-generational household, so you have wisdom from your grandma in your body, even though you're 12. So you're always, like, sitting between all these different ages. And I'm really excited to play with that modality and, like, with that idea.
So to what extent is that a war for you, and to what extent is it a kind of an opportunity for growth? And what I mean by that is, if somebody's telling you to be something else, if they're talking about your hair or your weight or things that don't comport, right, that's, I think, a moment when you might be at war with your body.
Yeah, I think so. There's another idea that we're really wrestling with in rehearsal around unpacking our bag. And I think we all carry things that we use as weapons and things that we use as shields. And how can we hold on to them and still use the things that can help us, but not use as a weapon anymore? Like, oh, I can reclaim this. I can reclaim this part of myself and use it in a way that helps me.
Let's talk about this in terms of Solange's album, particularly the song Don't Touch My Hair, because I understand that that is something that was very much in the background as you're putting your exhibit together. And so we'll play a little bit of that right here.
Don't touch my hair when it's the feelings I wear. Don't touch my soul when it's a rhythm I know. Don't touch my crown. They see the vision I've found. Don't touch what's there. When it's the feelings I wear.
A little bit of Solange Knowles' track, Don't Touch My Hair, her 2016 album, A Seat at the Table. I'm talking to artist Monet Noel Marshall. Her series of performance pieces address race and the value of self-worth, called Buy It, Call It. It's part of the trilogy, and she's with me now. How does that song speak to you?
First, I love that song. It just brings me great joy. It's an anthem. And beyond that, I think there are still instances in which particularly black women and black people deal with people coming up and touching their hair. I mean, even just recently, my friend came back from Boston. He's like in this bar and people just were coming to touch his hair in 2018. Like, this is still happening. And it's also a deeper message about, don't touch my hair. Don't take it and co-opt it and give it a new name. Don't take it and tell me it's ugly, but then when someone else is wearing it, it's okay. Don't take it and tell me it's unprofessional. So, like, in that idea of touch, it's really like a wider range of that.
What battles, I mean, have you fought battles? Have you recognized in yourself ways in which you were not accepting your own self, your own body image?
Yeah, absolutely. I think I think we're really good at internalizing the things that people tell us out in the world. And so for me, it was very much about being a like thick, like shapely child and like developing early. So there was one summer I was 10 years old. I saw my uncle. He's like, how old are you? 15. I was like, no, I'm 10. And then he saw me 2 months later. He's like, how old are you? 15. I'm like, nope. Still 10, you know? So, and that's like my uncle, someone who loves me and like has known me my whole life. So that, I think that speaks to the ways in which people in the world also were reacting to my body, which meant that I couldn't be a child if the rest of the world was interacting with me as a teenager. I needed to then be a teenager to protect myself and be able to navigate the world.
But it sounds like a lot of the healing comes through not sort of correcting people on how they perceive you or whether or not they hold these value judgments, but on being mindful and saying, oh, well, I get that that's what you think. I happen to love the way this is, which is a kind of a journey.
Right. And also this idea that like our bodies change every day.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that every time they change, I'm like, ooh, that's a change. I love that too. Ooh, that's a change. I'm going to accept that and love that too and not apologize for any of it.
You do this through your art. Now, I want to talk to you about also an exhibit right now at the CAM in Raleigh by artist Margaret Boland, because you've re-released part of your first the first part of your trilogy, and that was in part a response to that exhibit. Maybe you can tell me about the exhibit and some of the controversy that has spun around this.
Absolutely. So right now it's showing at CAM Raleigh, and the main pieces of that exhibit include Black girls who are dressed in more like almost Victorian dresses with their faces painted white. And it's really challenging to see, one, because in this moment, I think a lot of folks, if they were to see those images, they automatically assume that the artist is a Black woman or a Black person and is making a critique in the ways in which whiteness is enacted on us and the ways that we see ourselves. But then you find out it's a white woman. And then when you read her comments, it's very clear that she does not have an analysis on the ways that that can be harmful, those images can be harmful, and what they do and what they're actually saying. And part of the controversy also is around funding again, right? So I'm not about censorship. I think people should make whatever they want to make. What I am against is state-funded organizations or partly state-funded organizations making decisions that are harmful to communities that they should be in deep relationship with.
Well, and this gets back to the commodification of art and the fact that it is not integrated in the way that it was in, say, pre-capitalist worlds, where art and life and commerce were really very well integrated. Art wasn't a thing that stood apart from us and that
right.
hung in galleries and that had to be funded by state organizations. It's what you did. You danced and people sang and wore masks and made masks. How does an artist in your world, a world you can't change any of that, how do you navigate that?
Oh, such a great question. I think I feel incredibly grateful to be surrounded by artists that we are figuring, like we are in deep figuring around, okay, I may not be able to pay you right now, but when you work on your show, I'm going to help direct your show. Or like, okay, I can't afford to buy these costumes. Everyone look in their closet. So I think we create alternative economies around how can we share energy and space and resources. And that gives me a lot of hope around what else we can do.
Speaking of what else we can do, I want to talk about another element of your upcoming exhibit, which involves hair as well, and a bit of a surprise, but if you'll reveal it just for the 10 people who are listening to this show.
Sure. Here, 10 people. This is for you. So there's a piece, and it's called Tenderheaded, and it's this V, and you walk up to the V, and there's all these holes in the wall, and there's all this hair, like, coming out of the holes, and it say things like, stroke it, braid it, twist it, you know, pet it. And then it comes like, come around for more fun. And you walk around the back of the V and it's a Black woman seated in this chair and all the hair is coming out of her head. And, you know, we're still wrestling in rehearsal around like how is she responding in that moment? And so I guess that'll be the surprise because I don't know what's going to happen yet, y'all.
And this is only the second part. What's coming up for the third part? What are you planning?
Yeah. So it's called Buy My Art and Call It Holy. My biggest dream is for it to be in the lobby of the Nasher. And I really want to build a church. I want to build a sanctuary because there is a secondary definition of church. It's when the women gather after a birth. And for me, these three pieces really do feel like a rebirthing. And I think we've gotten the like anger at the systems. We've gotten the, okay, like I'm revealing. And now let's do some healing work together. So that will be really based in my belief around spirituality and movement and healing, and not just in a religious sense, but like full body, like joy.
Well, and that's the place, it sounds to me, where we really all come together. So
yeah.
The outer coat is very much objectified. And the inner is not personal narcissistic self, but that self which connects with the big wide world. So
yeah.
That sounds like great stuff. Well, we'll stay tuned. Always a pleasure, Monet.
Always.
You've got a space at this table anytime.
Thank you, Frank.
And our 10 listeners appreciate it. Monet Noel Marshall is a triangle-based artist. The second piece of her Buy It, Call It trilogy is entitled Buy My Body and Call It a Ticket. It premieres at the Durham Fruit and Produce Company June 8th, runs through the 16th. We've got it all at our website, stateofthings.org. What a pleasure.
Thank you.
Just ahead, we're going to take a serious look at the story behind Dollywood. Stay with us.